I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto.
Good evening, Vashon Island. I am Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel story show. Today, we're going to be talking about Ireland as we are quickly, very quickly approaching the day of St. Patrick's. The day that immortalized this crazy saint that people have been celebrating, and I'm not even really sure that anybody in America really knows what he did aside from drive the snakes out of Ireland. But he is the person who brought Christianity originally to the island. Adam, what are your thoughts on St. Patrick's Day?
Well, it's a lot to think about driving any snakes out of anywhere or bringing in Christianity to a perfectly intact pagan civilization. But gosh, top of the morning to you, dear Maggie. It's a real pleasure to be back here again at the Cats and Jammer Follies. And
I have recently read that probably in Ireland there just never were any snakes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a metaphor.
I wonder for what?
Gosh. You have a little story you're going to read today?
I do.
As we think about St. Paddy's Day.
And yes, it's an Irish story about, first off, it's by a writer named James Plunkett. I did not write this. And he was an Irish writer born in the 1920s and lived up until about 2003. So that was a pretty long stretch of time for any country, but in particular a small country like Ireland, who from the 20s onward for a very long time was very economically depressed. And he really captures a lot of that feeling in Ireland. There are a lot of wonderful, I was kind of trying to decide if I should read a crazy fairy tale story or if I should read this story, which is a little bit dark in nature, but I decided to go with this one. And there's all the facets of Ireland. Okay, again, this is James Plunkett, and it is called Janie Mary.
I like that name.
I do too. It's pretty cute. When Janie Mary turned the corner into Nicholas Street that morning, she leaned wearily against a shop front to rest. Her small head was bowed, and the hair with which was so nondescript and unclean covered her face. Her small hands gripped one another for warmth across the faded bodice of her frock. Around the corner lay Canning Cottages with their tiny, frost-gleaming gardens and gates that were noisy and freezing to touch. She had tried each one of them in turn. Her timid knock was well known to the people who lived in Canning Cottages. That morning, some of them said, "It's that little Carthy one, never mind opening. Twice in the last week she's been around. It's too much of a good thing." Those who did answer her answered her dour. They poked cross and harassed faces around half-open doors. "Tell her, Mammy," they said. "It's at school she should have her and not out worrying poor people the likes of them." They had their mouths of their own to feed and bellies to fill, and God knows that took doing. The school was in St. Nicholas Street, and children with satchels were already passing. Occasionally, Janie Mary could see a few paper books peeping from an open flap, and besides them, a child's lunch and a bottle of milk. In the schoolroom was a scrawled and incomprehensible blackboard and rows of staring faces which sniggered when Janie Mary was stupid in her answers. Sometimes Father Benedict would visit the school. He asked questions in catechism and gave the children sweets. He was a huge man who had more intention than intellect, more genuine affection for children than for learning. One day he found Janie Mary sitting by herself in the back desk. She felt him, giant-like, above her, bending over her. Some wrapped sweets were put on her desk. "And what's your name, little girl?" "Janie Mary Carthy, Father." "I'm Father Benedict of the Augustines." "Where do you live?" Father Benedict had pushed his way and shoved his way until he was sitting at the desk beside her. Quite suddenly, Janie Mary had felt safe and warm. She said easily, "I lives in Canning Cottages." He talked to her while the teacher continued self-consciously with her lesson. So your daddy works in the meat factory? No, Father, my daddy's dead. Father Benedict nodded and patted her shoulder. You and I must be better friends, Janie, he said. We must tell your mammy to send you to school more often. Yes, Father. Because we must see more of one another, mustn't we? Yes, Father. Would you always come? I'd like to, Father. Father Benedict had talked with her for some time like that, the pair of them crushed clumsily in the desk and their heads close together. When he was leaving, he gave her more sweets. Later, the teacher took them from her as a punishment and gave them out to the other ones as little prizes for neatness. She thought of Father Benedict until an old beggar who was passing her said, Are you winging, child? Is there anything up with you? She lifted her head and looked stupidly at him, her mouth open and her eyes quite dry. He was a humpbacked man with broken boots and a bulbous nose. The street about him was a moving forest of feet, the stolid tread of workmen and the pious shuffle of middle-aged women on their way from mass. You look a bit shook, kid, he said. Are you after taking a turn? No, mister, she said, wondering. I'm only going for a look for bread at St. Nicholas's. My mammy told me. Your mammy left it a bit late. They'll be going in to pray very soon. As though awkwarded by his words, the bell of the Augustinian friary rang three times. It rang out with long, resounding strokes across the quivering street, and people paused to uncover their heads and to bless themselves. Janie Mary looked up quickly. The steeple of the church rose clear and gleaming above the tall houses, and the golden slimness of the cross raced swiftly against the blue and gold of the sky. Her mother had said, Look till you find, my lady, and you won't lose your labor. This is the day of the blessed bread, and if you get it nowhere else, they'll be giving it out at St. Nicholas's. She turned suddenly and ran quickly up the length of the street. But when she reached the priory, the doors were closed and the waiting queue had broken into small knots. She stopped uncertainly and stared for some time. The priest and the people said they had gone in to pray. They would be back in an hour. She was glad to turn homewards. She was tired and her bare feet moved reluctantly on ice-cold pavement. Johnny might have been given some bread on his round with the sticks, or her mother might have some hidden away. Her mother sometimes did that, so that Janie Mary would have to try very hard to get some. Picking her way amongst the debris-littered wasteland with which houses once stood, she watched her shadow bobbing and growing with the uneven rippling of the ground. The light of the wintry sun rested wanly on everything, and the sky was dizzily blue and fluffed in little with white clouds. There were rust-eaten tin cans laying neglected on the waste, and fragments of colored delf which she could have gathered to play chanies had she had the time. The children often went there to play shop. They marked out their pitches with a file of pebbles in the form of an open square. When Janie Mary stood in one of those squares for a moment, she was no longer Janie Mary. The wasteland became a busy street and the tracery of pebbles glittering stores. Her face would grow grave. It was that serene gravity of a child at play. But when she stepped out of the magic square, she was again Janie Mary. A Janie Mary who was cold and who was hungry and whose mother was waiting impatiently for bread that had not been found. There was none, she said, looking up at her mother's face. Nobody would give it, and the man said the priest wouldn't be back for an hour. She looked round hopefully as they spoke, but there were only a few crumbs on the table. They littered its grease-fouled and flower-patterned covering. An enamel jug stood in the center, and about it slopped ugliness of used cups. Now that she was home, she realized how endless the morning's trudging had been. She realized how every door had been closed against her. Her mother's voice rose. Then you can do without. Are you after looking at it, you little trollop? 2 hours to go the length of the street and around to the holy priest and us all in wakeness with the hunger? And Johnny going out with the sticks and him famished, but for a little bit I have left away. Are you after looking at all? The enamel of the jug was broken in three places. The breaks were spidery like the blobs of ink which they used to fill so disheartenly on her copybooks. Down the side of each cup clung the yellow residue of dribbled tea. The whole table shifted suddenly and went back again, and her mother's voice seemed far away. Janie Mary desperately wanted to sit down. "Gallivanting? Gallivanting? Off gallivanting with your pals? I'll gallivant you," her mother said. "But you can go back again. There's nothing in the house. Back with you to the priest's house and wait like any Christian would wait for something. And take the bag with you. You won't do a hand's turn till you do that." Janie Mary stood with her hands clasped in front of her and looked up at her mother. The thought of going back out again filled her with misery. "I asked," she said. "I asked everywhere." "Then you can ask again," said her mother. "You can ask till you find," and swung away. Janie Mary went warily to the corner to fetch the bag. The kitchen trembled and became dark when she bent over to pick it up, and she went out the door. Her mother said, "Put a bit of hurry on yourself and don't be slinging. It's certain you'll never die with the beating of your heart. The world and its wife would get something and mine'd be left." Once more, she was out in the ancient crookedness of streets, picking her way amidst the trundling of wheels and the countless feet. Tiny and lost beneath the steepness of houses, she went slowly, her bare feet dragging and dirty. At this hour, the shops of St. Nicholas Street were crowded with women who haggled over halfpennies. White-coated assistants leaned quickly over marble-top counters with heads cocked to one side and pencils raised in readiness, or dashed from counters to shelves and back again, banging things on the scales and then licking pencil stubs while they frowned over figures. Sometimes Janie Mary used to stand and watch them, but now she went by without interest. When a tram went grinding past her, her lips trembled, and though the rails after it and before it gleamed in the sunlight, it seemed like a pale cold gleaming. There was no friendly heat in the sunlight. There was nothing friendly. There were only trundling trams and the tramp of feet, and once again the slim cross on the spire of St. Nicholas's. On the Feast of the Blessed Bread, it was with custom of the priest to erect a wooden counter on the high steps before the door of the priory. Here two of the brothers stood to watch the forming of the queue. Janie Mary looked hard through the veil, which blurred occasionally in front of her eyes, but could catch no sign of Father Benedict. No bread had yet appeared through the queue, though the queue was growing. She took her place and kept close to the wall. And near the wall, she found it easier to hold her position. It was very cold at first, but after a while, more people came and the air grew warmer. They came, and she had known they would, with baskets and shawls and torn shopping bags and ragged coats, and gathered quickly around her. There were men there too, old pensioners and men who hadn't worked for years. "There won't be much going," they said. "There was a shocking crowd here this morning." "Take your bloody hour," they said. "Who do you think you're pushing?" "Aisy, aisy, mind the chiseler." They talked like that for a minute. At first they argued furiously with one another, but later they became dour with impatience. They shuffled uncomfortably, they spat frequently, and heaved long sighs. After a while it became frightening to be in there, so close to the wall, to be so small that everybody towered over you. Janie Mary felt weak and wanted to get out. When she glanced sideways or ahead of her, she could see nothing but tightly packed bodies. And when she looked down, there were no feet, only ground. She tried to look upwards, but could not. An hour passed before Father Benedict appeared on the steps. "Father Benedict, God bless him," they said. "It'll be coming soon when he's here." Janie Mary was lifted clear off the ground by the movement of the crowd and lost her place. Now she was behind a stoop-backed man with a threadbare coat and heavily nailed boots. His collar was flaked and greasy with dandruff, and his coat was foul-smelling. But it was the boots which held Janie Mary's attention. They clattered unsteadily on the pavement very close to her bare feet. There were diamond-shaped nails in double rings about the heels of them. She bent to keep her eyes fixed on the boots and wriggled to avoid them. Her attention became fixed on them. To a man near her, she said, "I want to get out, mister. Please let me get out." But even if he had heard her, he could not have helped her. She tried to attract attention, but they had forgotten her. They kept telling one another over and over all the things that they already knew. "It's coming," they said, pressing forward. "It's coming." And after a while, the murmuring changed and the queue surged. "Look," they shouted, "it's here." Janie Mary was lifted one more time. Once more, her feet were clear of the ground and her breathing stifled by the pressure of those around her. She was in danger now, and Claude whimpering at the dandruff-flaked collar. Through a whirl of arms and shoulders, she had a view of Father Benedict, his broad shoulders tall and firm above the press of bodies. She tried to call out to him. "The chiseler," someone called, noticing. "For God's sake, quit pushing. Look at the chiseler." A man threw out his hand to grab her, but the movement of the crowd twisted him suddenly aside. She saw his hand grappling. She saw his hand grabbing futilely to her left. As the crowd parted, she began to slip. "Father Benedict," she called faintly. "Father Benedict." Then the man in front stumbled, and the nailed boots crushed down heavily on her feet. While her eyes opened again, she was on the sofa in the visitor's parlor. Father Benedict and one of the lay brothers was bending over her. Someone had put a rug about her. An electric fire glowed warmly against the opposite wall, and over it hung a gold frame picture of the Sacred Heart. Her feet felt numb and heavy, and the picture swam before her eyes. But it was warm in the parlor, and the morning searching was over. Then she suddenly remembered the bread and her mother's words. She moved suddenly, and when she tried to speak, her ears were filled with noise. The lay brother had turned to Father Benedict. "You were very quick," he said. "Is she badly hurt?" Father Benedict answered. In a strange voice, "Only her feet. You can see the print of the nails." Okay. And cue you there. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. But it was warm in the parlor, and the morning searching was over. Then she remembered the bread and her mother's words. She moved suddenly. When she tried to speak, her ears were filled with noise. The lay brother had turned to Father Benedict. "You were very quick," he was saying. "Is she badly hurt?" Father Benedict, answering him, said in a strange voice, "Only her feet. You can see the print of the nails."
I alone the prison wall. I heard a young girl calling. Michael. Stole Trevelyan's car so the young might see the mark. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay.
My guest, Adam Cohn, who's also my husband and is also a beautiful writer, which I always talk about, he has a poem that he wrote in Ireland. Do you have any precursor words you want to say?
Well, gosh, I don't know. Megan. It's a lot to follow a story like the one that you just read. It was beautiful and had a lot of parts to it that I think it's possible to really identify with some of the kind of intense feelings that come with a little country and an economy and a time in the world where people are...
And a hard history.
Yeah. Right. You know, our own history of visiting this island country is special. We're coming from far away in a land of so much available. But I fell in love with a small area of Ireland called Kilkelly and read... on an earlier show, got a chance to read about a little house and some time there together with you. But
which is our favorite place to go.
It is, I think so, mm-hmm. aside from our home here on Vashon. This is a short little poem about a walk that I took in the rain because I was under the impression in August that maybe there would be something other than rain in Ireland, but it's okay. It turns out that there is not. And so this is my reconciling of that geography and of that climate.
As the Irish say, you don't go to Ireland for the weather.
Right. Well, I certainly learned that on this trip. But anyway, regardless, it's a little poem about a lake and a walk. I'll preface it. The first word within the poem is an Italian word. It's called rondini, and that word means barn swallow, or like house martin, those little birds that careen and fly and they come in the spring and leave in the fall. That's the Italian word for that. So that's the beginning of this poem. Maybe that's his title. Rondini. The flat slate gray of Lake Urlar. House martin, swallow, barn swallow. It is completely silent here, save for the mechanical ambling of farm equipment some distance away. Wetland, cottonwood, an occasional bright yellow of tansy through the muted greens of early August. Himalayan blackberry and soft fireweed break up the fields and climb over the collected stones and ravine that delineate one farm, one property from another. Freshwater shoreline and milky swamp green. Small bird and cow's friendly call across the water. Dogs, tractor, again quiet wave. It is here the fields merge with one another, converging lakeside in the shallows. Dark reeds and primordial silt. The agricultural flies are resourceful and garner my attention in their repeated efforts to land in or on my nose and face. Only the steady rain and constant walking defeat their earnest visits. The way home is slow, wet asphalt, and the dry, warm, russet pink of heather. Like large patches of wild thyme, soft-hued rose and brown-green that ring Lake Urlar and balance the gray sky that I've come to know as Ireland. Gentle cows now rest under stand of hawthorn, creamy tan and white. They swish their tails and chew the afternoon away. Ah, Irlanda, the rains of summer. Again, fireweed, dark pink. It is indeed a good summer to be. Thanks a lot for letting me read that.
It's a beautiful poem, Adam. Thank you.
You can pretty much walk anywhere in this country and feel like you've accomplished some measure of kilometers, and even a dialect changes within the course of about 4 miles. certainly the mashed potatoes do.
The mashed potatoes. I know, right? I'll be making boxty this weekend.
That's excellent.
For St. Patrick's Day. Boxty is like the Irish potato pancake.
Right.
It's kind of good.
It is good. It's totally good. All of it's good. Yeah. Brown sauce and weird things. Yeah.
But they're not really known for their cuisine.
Well, that's all right.
I know.
In their own right. We really miss, I know I speak for both you and I when I say that we really miss being able to travel like all of us do. And I certainly look forward to getting on that very first flight we can to land somewhere with limited amenities. And the excitement prevails.
Yes. But, hoping at the end of May.
Right. That sounds good.
Yeah. Who knows how this will all play itself out. But
I know you have a little poem to read again by Yeats.
I do.
I'll finish up with one more too if there's time.
Yep.
When
I was, I've said this before on other shows, but when I was a freshman in high school, I went to school there. And during the school year, I was, part of my curriculum was to memorize a poem by William Butler Yeats. And it's very short and very sweet. And I have loved it my whole life. And it is called Aid Wishes for the Cloths of Heaven. Had I the heaven's embroidered cloths, inwrought with golden and silver light, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths of night and light and the half-light, I would spread the cloths under your feet, but I, being poor, have only my dreams. I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams. That is a beautiful poem, and William Butler Yeats, he's notoriously from the county of Sligo, which is also a very beautiful city, not unlike how Galway is a university town. So it has a very young, good feeling to it. And there's a museum.
And it sits right there on the river too, which is really great. Not far really, just north of where we spend some time and talk about things.
Yeah,
for sure.
We spent time in County Mayo, and right. he was from the county just above it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. I too will end up with one more little poem for this St. Patrick's Day show, and it was written about a year ago, kind of before all this kind of COVID began. But we were in Ireland, and it was at the end of the year, and that's that kind of begins. But I'll begin. It is the end of the year, and starlings' joyful screams carry through the branches and small streets of Inishere. That's the littlest island off the coast of Galway, the Aran Islands. Arduous and bereft of ease, the last 12 months, we look forward, all of us, to seasons that will come without these feelings. The day at home is clear, blue sky after the winds and Atlantic storms of yesterday. Back bare against the wood stove, cozy, and the bakers sleep till long past 10. Tavron, cows, brown and black, creamy white and red, gently amble about the fields around this old house.
Her eyes, they shone like diamonds, you'd think she was queen of the land. And her hair hung over her shoulder, tied up with a black velvet band.
In a neat little town they call Belfast, apprentice to trade I was bound. And many an hour sweet happiness I spent in that neat little town. Till bad misfortune came o'er me, that caused me to stray from the land. Far away from me friends and relations, they follow the black velvet fan.
Her eyes, they shone like the diamonds, you'd think she was queen of the land. And her hair hung over her shoulders, tied up with a black velvet band.
Well, I went out strolling one evening, not meaning to go very far.
Thank you very much. I hope that everybody has a really beautiful St. Patrick's Day, and that this year, it was exactly a year ago, right before St. Patrick's Day, every year we have a big party over at Snapdragon, and we were given the crazy mandate to shut down a couple days before, and we had planned to have a big party and
drink green beer
and have a contest.
Celebration.
Yeah, have a costume contest, and yes, we were going to give somebody a free ticket to Ireland, and that didn't work. And we're not having a party this year either, but let's all just hope that we can have one giant one come summer and listen to some beautiful music. And
if you see a leprechaun, be sure to be looking for the pot of gold, because it might be right behind you. Thank you.
A long time ago when the earth was green, and there was more kinds of animals than you'd ever seen. They'd run around free while the earth was being born. But the loveliest of them all was the unicorn. There was green alligators and long-necked geese, some Humpty Beckhamers and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, the loveliest of all was the unicorn.